Okay, welcome. This is episode 301 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine, and today's podcast is going to be visiting a topic that is incredibly high for the USMLE exams. I'm going to be calling this Diabetes and the USMLEs. My hope in this podcast is to cover pretty much everything that you'd expect to see in an MBME question all the way from step one all the way to step three concerning diabetes, so that you're pretty much good to go. And as a reminder, if you're taking the step two CQ or step three exams, I have an MBME test taking strategies course on the 27th of this month from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'll essentially have about a couple of MBME style questions, and we'll use them to go over a systematic process for reading questions, answering questions, and avoiding pitfalls that many people fall for in the exam. And then from the 28th of April to the 1st of May, I am going to be having a 20-hour super comprehensive review course. We'll be covering peds, surgery, OB-GYN, IM, psych, neuro, biostats, ethics, professionalism, basically those changes that showed up in November of 2020 last year. And also we'll be covering relevant step one content that has made its way to step two CK. So it's like a one-stop shop. Again, many people have participated in this course, done extremely well. I mean, I'm not going to say like straight up numbers, but I know there is a person that has attended my course that has gotten close to a 280 on their exams. So the course is really comprehensive, and I'm making it better and better and better each time. So again, if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email and through the website, and I'll give you some more details on cost and things like that. And for those of you listening, you know, hopefully in the future, I would hold a step one course, probably like sometime around June or something. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email and I'll guide you in the right direction. Okay, so let's go ahead and start, right? So diabetes, right? So diabetes is a big, big, big topic, right? And again, it's something that many people understand the basics, but many people, again, sadly, don't really understand pathophysiology, right? So let's kind of hit on many of the things with diabetes. And again, diabetes is one of these amazing topics where you can do just lots and lots and lots and lots of integration, right? So again, this is a diabetes podcast, but again, you'll end up learning like a ton of other stuff, right? You learn a ton of other stuff. So I'll just encourage you to just pay attention, take good notes, listen, understand. This is one of those podcasts that you want to listen to multiple times. I think it will ultimately help you. Okay, so diabetes, right? So we know that diabetes is bad, right? I mean, it affects many people in the US, and it's particularly common in people that are, you know, African Americans, and it's also common in Native Americans, and also people that are from Alaska, for whatever bizarre reason. Those people tend to have a diabetes, right? And we know that diabetes causes many bad things, right? Diabetes is the thing that makes people blind, it makes people have kidney issues, makes people have nerve issues, right? And again, you know, I will talk about the pathophysiology behind many of those things, right? So the thing with diabetes is essentially the final common pathway of everything with diabetes is the person's blood glucose is really, really high, right? Person's blood glucose is really, really high. But the way you get there is different, right? The way you get there is different, right? Essentially, your blood glucose will be really, really high because you don't have adequate amounts of insulin activity, right? So you may say, okay, Divine, how do I get to a situation where I don't have adequate amounts of insulin activity? Well, we'll talk about that, right? So usually when a person presents with diabetes, what are some symptoms they could present with, right? So remember, especially when they present like in these diabetic emergency situations, they'll present with polydipsia, right? So you may ask yourself, okay, Divine, what's the pathophys there? Well, if a person is not getting adequate amounts of insulin activity, then they will have a lot of glucose kind of strain around in your bloodstream. Well, glucose is very osmotically active, right? So it can be filtered, you'll get filtered in the kidneys. And then if you exceed the transport maximum of those proximal convoluted tubule cells, which is right around 180 milligrams. So basically at a blood glucose level of about 180 milligrams per deciliter, you exceed the ability of those proximal convoluted tubule cells, those are SGLT2 receptors, to reabsorb glucose, right? So glucose will then start showing up in the urine. As that glucose shows up in the urine, it's going to draw water with it. And if it draws water with it, well, you're going to have a lot of, you're going to be peeing a ton. Well, if you pee a ton, then sadly, your body will be like, okay, I need water, right? So you're going to drink a ton, right? So that's polydipsia, polyuria, right? And these people also have polyphagia. So in fact, I always wondered, why do people that have diabetes have polyphagia, right? But again, if you think about it, in diabetes, again, I said you're not getting an insulin effect. Well, what does insulin do? Insulin is the thing that literally feeds your cells, right? If you think of insulin as a cell feeder, then this polyphagia would make sense, right? Because if your insulin is not around, right, then you're not feeding your cells, especially like your muscles, right, and your adipose cells. Remember, your muscles and your adipose cells are examples of insulin-dependent tissues, right? The examples of insulin-dependent tissues. In fact, when people have diabetes, the thing that happens is that the insulin-dependent tissue is not getting anything, right? Like, because again, remember, insulin makes you put more GLUT4 transporters on the surfaces of your adipocytes and your skeletal muscle, right? So if you have an insulin deficiency, you're not going to be putting GLUT4 receptors on your skeletal muscle and adipocytes. So those things starve. So your body is like, man, I'm hungry, right? That's why people that have diabetes, right, especially type 2 diabetes, they tend to eat a ton, right? So we may then say, okay, so what are the ways that people get, what are the different ways that people kind of gets to diabetes? Well, a person can have type 1 diabetes, a person can have type 2 diabetes, right? We know that type 1 diabetes, classically on MBM exams, you'll present in a teenager, right? You present in a teenager or a very young adult, right? Usually a person that's less than 30 years old. And they'll tell you in the question that, or the person has been, it can be like a person that's developed secondary enuresis, right? So the person out of the blue starts bedwetting, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, again, you want to think about type 1 diabetes, right? Because again, that polyuria. So that kid can start bedwetting, or they can tell you something about the kid, like, you know, he has lost like 10 pounds or 5 pounds over a very short period of time, has polyuria, has polydipsia, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, again, you want to think about diabetes, especially type 1 diabetes. And sometimes the primary presentation of type 1 diabetes can literally be DKA. In fact, I think about 1 out of every 4 people that are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, the first presentation in those people is a diabetic ketoacidosis. So you may say, okay, Divine, why do people develop type 1 diabetes? Well, they can get it for many reasons, right? So the big thing you want to remember is inflammation, right? Big thing you want to remember is inflammation, right? So the thing is, especially for those that are taking step 1, your friends at the MBME, they kind of want you to know some basic science details that underlie how type 1 diabetes develops, right? So for example, one thing that can cause type 1 diabetes is if for some reason you have a failure of immune tolerance, right? Because remember, in type 1 diabetes, it's almost like an autoimmune diabetes. You're pretty much just going and destroying the pancreatic beta islet cells, right? So you may say, oh, what is causing me to destroy the pancreatic beta islet cells? Well, the thing that's causing it is your immune system that normally does not destroy those cells says, this thing looks foreign to me. Let me go ahead and destroy it. And one nice integration that you can actually keep at the back of your mind for MBM exams is that people that have type 1 diabetes, in some cases, they have mutations in a gene that's known as CTLA4, right? CTLA4. If you remember, again, CTLA4 is one of these genes you don't see discussed in many resources, but it's actually high to know for the USMLE exams, especially step 1, right? So if you have a mutation in CTLA4, CTLA4 is something that normally suppresses T cells, right? It's one of those mechanisms potentially behind a person developing self-tolerance. Because again, your body, your T cells are not supposed to destroy your pancreas. That's literally not their job description, right? So your beta cells, right, and many cells in the body, right? But let's you know, focus on the beta cells. They produce CTLA-4, and that CTLA-4 tells those T cells, okay, shut it, don't come here, don't destroy us, right? But if a person has a CTLA-4 mutation, then they are not able to tell those T cells to shut it. And if those T cells don't shut it, they come and destroy the person's pancreatic islets, right? So that all, especially the beta cells, right? So that ultimately causes issues. That's how people develop type 1 diabetes, right? So again, they have like a failure of self-tolerance, right? In fact, classically, when you do a biopsy of the pancreas of a patient that has type 1 diabetes, you usually find like a lymphocytic infiltrate. That's a higher factoid to know for the exams, right? And again, some of you may be like, oh, Divine, this CTLA-4, is there any other reason why I should keep this thing in mind? Well, the thing is, certain cancers actually upregulate CTLA-4. When you upregulate CTLA-4, you're going to dumb down T cells. Because remember, one of the ways that our bodies prevent us from getting cancer is that T cells are very good anti-cancer cells, right? So many malignancies, especially some lung cancers, they do this thing with upregulating CTLA-4. So you can essentially neuter those T cells. And when you neuter those T cells, they're not going to come and attack the cancer, right? That's why we've actually like made some drugs. I'm not going to go into that now because that's not the purpose of this podcast. But if you think of some lung cancer drugs, especially like you hear of these anti-PD-1 agents and all these CTLA-4 therapies, drugs like nivolumab, for example, these are drugs that all work through that CTLA-4 pathway ultimately to, you know, cause your immune system to be activated so that it can start attacking the malignancy. But again, that's a discussion for another day, right? So, and the thing is, again, when these T cells are activated, remember, T cells can pair up or partner up with B cells, you know, help them class switch, right? And then you make antibodies, right? So the thing is, in people that have type 1 diabetes, they can actually develop autoantibodies, right? They can develop autoantibodies against insulin. They can develop autoantibodies against the pancreatic beta cells, right? So if you actually really think about this, because your friends at the MBME, they can kind of bring this back to the realm of immunology, right? So type 1 diabetes is actually a type 2 and a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. The type 4 hypersensitivity reaction part is your T cells doing the damage. The type 2 hypersensitivity reaction part is those autoantibodies that are made that perform a lot of destruction, right? So that's something that's kind of high yield to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And remember that people that, again, it's not just having these gene mutations that can increase a person's risk of type 1 diabetes, right? These people, unfortunately, also have certain genetic susceptibilities, right? Or environmental susceptibilities. So one thing I would just encourage you to keep in mind is if people have like, if they have like HLA-DR3, HLA-DR4, those things are associated with them developing type 1 diabetes. Again, it's not everyone that has HLA-DR3, DR4 that develops diabetes. But if you have that, you are at elevated risk of developing diabetes, right? So again, remember, especially type 1 diabetes, again, remember, it's not the fact that you just have those things, right? You also need like the right perfect storm of environmental conditions. And I know you may be like, wow, Divine is saying so much about genetics. So genetics must play like a monster role in the development of type 1 diabetes. Again, that's true. But genetics play even more of a monster role in type 2 diabetes than type 1 diabetes. I mean, many of these things have been proven by like these twin concordance studies, right? I mean, it's roughly about like if you have like two twins, right? And one has type 1 diabetes, the risk of the other one having type 1 diabetes is about 50%. But if you have a twin with type 2 diabetes, the risk of the other one developing type 2 diabetes is about 90%, right? So there's a stronger actually genetic basis for type 2 diabetes compared with type 1 diabetes, right? So that's kind of like the big thing with type 1 diabetes. And again, remember, people that have type 1 diabetes, those people, their pancreas has essentially burnt out, right? So their pancreas is burnt out. So because their pancreas is burnt out, they're essentially not going to be able to make insulin, right? So really the only treatment for type 1 diabetes for the most part is to give those people insulin, right? Is to give those people insulin. And I mean, there are many different kinds of insulin, right? There's like, you know, like the ultra rapid. In fact, maybe let me say something about insulin. So the thing is, we know that the way normal physiology works for most human beings, right? Actually, for human beings, you know, normal person, is that the body does this thing where it has, if you check a person, like a normal person, if you check their blood, there will always be insulin in it, right? Because the thing is, your cells need a constant, consistent supply of glucose to eat, right? So the thing is, you have like this basal level of insulin that's always released. But then whenever you eat, right, whenever you, you know, go to a fast food restaurant or you eat at home or whatever, then there's this big spike in your blood glucose, right? So your body like can say, oh, you know what? I release these normal amounts of insulin. Let me have these big spikes, right? So whenever you eat, you have a big spike of glucose. And again, what's the thing that controls those? So you have that big spike of glucose, so your insulin spikes in return. So how does your insulin spike in return? It's through something called an incretin, right? It's through something called an incretin, right? That incretin is a GLP-1, right? It's called GLP-1. They're actually produced by the L cells in your GI tract, right? So those things, they cause some signaling that ultimately causes you to produce insulin in response to a meal. So when glucose touches your stomach, your small intestine, you start making all these incretins that causes you to release insulin, right? And again, insulin doesn't just come out of the blue, right? Insulin comes, when you want to release insulin, because remember, if you consume glucose, that glucose has to enter the pancreatic beta cell. Remember, the pancreatic beta cells have a GLUT2 receptor, right? So the glucose will come in through the GLUT2 receptor, which is bidirectional, by the way, to the pancreatic beta cells. And in those pancreatic beta cells, we know that that glucose can be converted to glucose 6-phosphate by an enzyme known as glucokinase, right? And again, all these things you see me saying, I'll bring in some integrations in a second, right? So that glucose is converted to glucose 6-phosphate by glucokinase. And then that glucose 6-phosphate, you know, it will go through glycolysis, TCA cycle, electron transport chain, you make a ton of ATP. Well, in a pancreatic beta islet cell, that ATP has the ability to close certain potassium channels. When it closes those potassium channels, right, potassium is not going to be leaking out of the cell anymore. So the cell will have a buildup of positive charges that will cause the cell to depolarize. When the cell depolarizes, then certain calcium channels that are voltage gated will open, right? So those calcium channels have the ability to open by changes in voltage, right? So if the cell depolarizes, the voltage is becoming more positive. So that's going to cause those calcium channels to open. Calcium will come in, right? And when that calcium comes in, that's then going to cause you to take these vesicles that contain bags of insulin, and then they are released into the circulation, right? And remember, whenever insulin is released, it doesn't get released alone. It gets released with a bunch of stuff, actually, right? So it gets released, I will say probably like the big thing to keep at the back of your mind is C-peptide, right? So whenever insulin is coming from the body, right? Or from an insulin-based malignancy in the body, like an insulinoma, the person's insulin levels will be elevated. The person's C-peptide will be elevated, right? And the thing is, insulin, as it's leaving the pancreatic beta cell, because those pancreatic beta cells, they're actually in the center of the islets. So it's almost like they secrete this insulin and it's like radiating outwards, right? So in the islets, beta cells that produce insulin in the center, but the alpha cells that produce glucagon, they're actually in the periphery, right? So as that insulin is coming out, it actually hits those pancreatic alpha cells that produce glucagon and inhibits their secretion of glucagon, right? So again, you're making insulin, you're making C-peptide, right? So if, for example, a person, you know, classically on NBM exams, it'll be like a healthcare worker or a medical student or a nurse of some sort, and you notice that they keep having all this hypoglycemia, right? And they may say something about, maybe this person has like a psychiatric history, right? And then they can tell you the question that, wow, this person's insulin is elevated, but their C-peptide is undetectable. Whenever you see stuff like that, right, you want to think about factitious hypoglycemia, right? The person is essentially just making up symptoms, right? So that they can, they want to essentially draw attention to themselves, right? So that's factitious hypoglycemia, right? So, you know, they'll have Whipple's triad. Whipple's triad, again, many people know this, is pretty obvious, right? It's a pretty obvious triad, right? They'll have hypoglycemia, they'll have signs of hypoglycemia, and they'll have relief of symptoms, right, with glucose administration. So the fact that their insulin is high and their C-peptide is undetectable, that tells you that, this person is probably making up their symptoms in some way, shape, or form, right? This person is picking up symptoms in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, if you see an elevated insulin and elevated C-peptide, well, that means the insulin is coming from within the body. But the thing is, insulin can come from within the body from natural processes, right? Or it can come from cancer, like an insulinoma, right? Or it can come from you forcing your body to make higher levels of insulin than is normal, right? So say, for example, a sulfonylurea, right? Because if you remember, we kind of talked about how ATP blocks those potassium channels that we find on the in the pancreatic beta cells, which will cause the cell to depolarize. And then voltage-gated calcium channels will open, bringing calcium, and then you secrete bags of insulin, right? So sulfonylureas, they essentially block that potassium channel, right, to cause you to release a ton of insulin. That's also the exact, so sulfonylureas, right, so things like clopropamide, tobutamide, and then there's, I think, like the second generation ones like glyburide, glipizide, glimepiride, right? Those things all work by blocking potassium channels. And by the way, there's also a group of, I almost call them like non-sulfonylurea, sulfonylureas, right? So these are drugs like your meglidinides, right? They're called meglidinides, repaglinide, nateglinide. Those things also block those potassium channels. But the thing is, they're a little more rapid acting than the regular sulfonylureas, right? So those things, because they block those potassium channels, they can cause you to release a ton of insulin. They can cause you to release a ton of C-peptide, right? So the thing that will happen in those circumstances is people that are abusing sulfonylureas, because they may be like, oh, wow, the healthcare system is smart. They will check my C-peptide levels, right? So those people, right, they're essentially taking an insulin secretor gog. That's a buzzword you want to recognize for NBM exams, right? Like a sulfonylurea or meglidinide, right? So their insulin is elevated, their C-peptide is elevated. So you may say, okay, Divine, so how am I going to differentiate these people from people that have like some kind of insulinoma? Well, the way you're going to make that differentiation is by doing a secretor gog screen. It's essentially like a blood test for sulfonylureas, right? So their insulin will be elevated, their C-peptide will be elevated, but they will have like a positive blood test that, oh, these people are taking some kind of secretor gog like a sulfonylurea or a meglidinide, and then you essentially catch them in the act, right? But again, that's not the only direction your friends at the NBME can take with these C-peptides. If you remember, I'm essentially discussing the different NBME contexts for C-peptide levels, right? One thing you want to keep in mind is actually differentiating between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, literally by C-peptide levels, right? For the most part, people that have type 1 diabetes, the pancreas is essentially, their beta cells in the pancreatic islets are burnt out, right? So those people, again, they're not making insulin. If they're not making insulin, they're not going to be making C-peptide. So in type 1 diabetes, the C-peptide levels are actually low, right? In fact, one experiment, because again, remember your friends at the USMLE that write these step 1 exams, they love to write these experiment-based questions. They can actually give you a question about a person and they're trying to establish the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, right? And then they'll say which of the following is the expected result with glucagon infusion, right? I would hope you're telling me that, oh, Divine, if a person is a type 1 diabetic, if we give them a glucagon infusion, their C-peptide levels will fail to rise. So what's the pathophysiology there? Well, again, if you give a person glucagon is a counter-regulatory hormone, right? So it's going to raise the person's blood glucose levels. If the person's blood glucose goes up, right, that's going to trigger a release of insulin, right? And as insulin is being released in higher measure, C-peptide will be released in higher measure. But if your pancreas is not working for whatever reason, right, then you're not going to be able to have that response, right? So whenever you see a person where, oh, you give them a glucagon infusion, they give you an experiment-based question on the exam, a person gets a glucagon infusion and their C-peptide levels fail to increase with glucagon infusion, that's a pretty good diagnostic test for type 1 diabetes on NBME exams. Although, again, there are many other things we use to diagnose diabetes in folks, right? But again, if a person has type 2 diabetes, right, they have like insulin resistance, right? And again, I know I haven't talked about type 2 diabetes. There are just some quick integrations I want to talk about before I keep going. But people that have type 2 diabetes, they have, at least especially like in the early phase of disease, they have insulin resistance. So they're making a ton of insulin, right? That ton of insulin they're making is going to be made with a ton of C-peptide, right? So again, C-peptide levels tend to be high in people that have type 2 diabetes, but they tend to be low or non-existent in people that have type 1 diabetes, right? And again, some other integrations I just want to kind of, you know, talk about along the way, right? I talked about how incretins can cause you to release more insulin, right? GLP-1 is the chief of them all, right? Remember, those incretins, we can actually make, pharmacological incretins, right? Those GLP-1 agonists, right? So drugs like exenatide, liraglutide, right? So those things, they cause you to literally make more insulin, right? So that's why those drugs can actually be used in type 2 diabetes, where your pancreas is actually still working, right? Remember, those exenatide, liraglutide, they actually cause weight loss. And the reason there is that those things, they actually decrease your gastric emptying. So they give you that sense of feeling full very quickly, right? So you don't eat as much, right? So those things can actually cause weight loss. In fact, I believe liraglutide has been approved by the FDA for weight loss. Another thing you can also do to, increase your incretins, right, is to decrease the activity of the enzyme that breaks them down, right? The enzyme that breaks down incretins, the enzyme that breaks down GLP-1 is called DPP4, dipeptidyl peptidase 4, right? So that can tell you that it's, something that cleaves the peptide bonds, right? So there are DPP4 inhibitors that are also diabetes drugs, right? So drugs like they are the gliptins, right? Like alogliptin, linagliptin, saxagliptin, sitagliptin, right? Those drugs are DPP4 inhibitors. By being DPP4 inhibitors, they essentially decrease the breakdown of GLP-1, right? So GLP-1 can do its job. Now, the big thing with these drugs that's like a subtle difference, but it's kind of high yield, is that these drugs are actually weight neutral, right? They're not like the GLP-1 analogs. They are weight neutral. But one thing I would just say is the GLP-1 analogs, right? Remember, those things can actually increase a person's risk of pancreatitis, right? So if a person has a history of alcoholism, that may be a relative contraindication to those drugs on MBM exams. And also, if a person has a history of medullary thyroid cancer or some disease that predisposes them to medullary thyroid cancer, so like MEN, any of those MEN2 syndromes, right? Those people should also not take the GLP-1 analog. I believe as those drugs were being made, I think there was an increased incidence of medullary thyroid cancer in rats that were exposed to those drugs. So that's why there's that warning, I believe, from the FDA. And then I've kind of talked about how sulfonylurea is, right? Again, they're pretty great for, they block those potassium channels that we're finding in the pancreatic beta islet cells, right? By blocking those potassium channels, right, the cell will depolarize and make more insulin. So if you really notice, when a person is taking a sulfonylurea, they're literally giving themselves insulin, right? So sulfonylureas, it should make sense that they cause weight gain, right? So you may say, oh, Divine, okay, why is that weight gain? The thing is, insulin is literally a growth factor, right? Like insulin makes your muscle cells, right? Again, you put more GLUT4 transporters on their surface, you're bringing more glucose, right? So it makes your muscle cells grow, right? But also another cell type that, has GLUT4 transporters are your adipocytes, right? So your adipocytes, they have a lot of, your adipocytes are insulin dependent tissues, right? So as you put more GLUT4 receptors on their surfaces, right, you're going to bring in more glucose, right? And that glucose, again, ultimately can be made into fat, right? So again, you can see you're basically like increasing the size of your adipocytes, right? So as you have more and more of that, right, again, that's going to make you fat, right? So sulfonylureas, they definitely cause weight gain. And then on those potassium channel businesses, right? I mean, many of us, have probably memorized at some point in the past, oh, the thiazides cause, hyperglucose, right? Many people know that mnemonic that, oh, they cause hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia, hyperuricemia, hypercalcemia. Again, I'm not going to explain all those things. I'm just going to explain the endocrine relevant parts. But the thing is, thiazides, one thing they actually do is they actually open up potassium channels. Thiazides are potassium channel openers, right? So if you're a potassium channel opener, you open up those potassium channels that we find in the pancreatic beta islet cells. I don't know, you're making more potassium leak out, so that cell is not going to depolarize. So you're not going to release insulin, right? So when you take a thiazide, you can develop almost like a relative insulin deficiency. And if you're insulin deficient, you can already begin to see that, okay, you're not going to be able to regulate your blood glucose well. So you're going to get hyperglycemia, right? And if your insulin deficient, again, your adipose cells are not going to be able to take up glucose. And because remember, one of the things insulin also does is it actually activates lipoprotein lipase, right? So that you can bring in free fatty acids and monoacylglycerol into the adipocyte, right? So, and store fat. So basically, right, like if you have an insulin deficiency because you've opened up potassium channels with a thiazide, you can already begin to see that, oh, wow, I'm not going to be able to bring in free fatty acids. So those fats is just going to hang out in your blood, right? So you're going to get hyperlipidemia. And then, you know, we know that thiazides, well, that potassium channel opening effect is also, you know, kind of good. Because if you open up potassium channels, right, especially like in the, like the cells that line your blood vessels, right, that's going to cause those blood vessel walls to relax, right? So thiazides have a vasodilatory effect, right? That's actually why they're, that's one of their blood pressure lowering effects. So many people just think, oh, thiazides are diuretics. Yes, that's true. They make you lose fluid. So, you know, your blood volume goes down, blood pressure goes down. But they also have a vasodilatory effect. That's why usually on USMLE exams, they'll tell you that when a person is taking a thiazide, it's maybe not the most genius idea in the world for them to be taking an NSAID, because an NSAID is essentially going to blunt those effects, those vasodilatory effects of thiazides, right? Because NSAIDs, right, by inhibiting cyclooxygenase, your prostaglandin levels will go down, right? So you're going to get like a vasoconstrictive effect, right? And then remember thiazides, right? Like they literally are excreted. They compete for the same transporters that help you get rid of uric acid, right, in the nephron, right? So your uric acid will build up because it's not being excreted at its normal rate, right? So you get hyperuricemia. The hypercalcemia is more of a complicated mechanism. I believe I've discussed that in my renal reviews, and I have a renal pharmacology podcast, so I'm not going to go into that, but thiazides definitely cause hypercalcemia, right? And then so those are all, you know, kind of like high yield things to kind of keep at the back of your mind, all these different integrations. In fact, one integration I can even mention, right? Like many of us think of glucokinase, right? I said that glucokinase is specifically found in the pancreatic beta islet cells. You know, you can find it in many other places, right? But, you know, let's talk about it in the context of the pancreatic beta islet cells. That glucokinase, right? It literally converts glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, right? But again, after you make that glucose 6-phosphate, you make ATP that will block those potassium channels and then make you release insulin. Well, if you kind of think about it, let's assume a person has a glucokinase mutation, right, where it has like a loss of function mutation, or it may have a mutation where, you know, it's not as sensitive to glucose. Then you can already begin to imagine that, wow, this person will need higher than normal levels of glucose to trigger the same release of insulin. So let's say, oh, if your blood glucose was like 200, you start, like, let's not go ridiculous here. Let's say your blood glucose was like 100, that triggers release of insulin. But because you have a glucokinase mutation, you know, it's not very sensitive. Remember, glucokinase is like a glucose sensor, right? And you have like some gene mutation, right? And it's not like super, super, super sensitive, right? Then you're not going to be sensing blood glucose levels. So let's say maybe your blood glucose levels of 100 triggered glucokinase activity, but now it's taking a blood glucose level of 250. To trigger glucokinase activity, then you're going to have periods in your life where your blood glucose is really high, but you're not secreting adequate amounts of insulin to deal with that problem, right? In fact, that glucokinase mutation is something that's essentially the pathophase in many cases of maturity onset diabetes of the young, right? And also pregnant people that have diabetes, like gestational diabetes, that glucokinase gene mutation is one pathophase behind that, right? So that's kind of like a nice way to integrate that there. And although, I mean, you should also think about it, another thing that makes people that are pregnant more predisposed to diabetes is this hormone that's made by the placenta, right? Human placental lactogen. That human placental lactogen, right? It's a diabetogenic hormone, right? So it causes these people to be predisposed, because again, that makes sense, right? Because you're trying to you want to have like higher than normal levels of glucose in your blood if you're pregnant, right? So that glucose can be available to cross the placenta to feed baby, right? So that will make sense. And you know, when you're pregnant as well, you also have very high levels of progesterone, right? When your progesterone is really high, progesterone is also diabetogenic, right? So it raises a person's blood glucose levels, right? And progesterone, you know, it's one of the reasons why pregnant women, they love to eat, right? As a pregnant woman, you're like eating up a storm. In fact, this is one of the reasons why there's this progesterone analog. It's called megestrol acetate. It's actually used in people that have cancer, like cancer-related cachexia. You can use that to actually spruce up those people's appetite, right? So with all that said, right, so that's essentially the big pathophys behind type 1 diabetes and, you know, all those integrations I wanted to make. And again, I said type 1 diabetes, we treat it with insulin, right? Treat it with insulin, right? And that insulin, again, there are many types of insulin. And I kind of talked about the way the body works with insulin, right? We said, I think that was how we went down this incretin, like, just mountain. We said that, you know, you have a basal level of insulin, right? And then you have, like, insulin spikes when you eat a meal. Right, so that kind of tells you why, again, a type 1 diabetic, they can only, the insulin is the only treatment for a type 1 diabetic, right? So those people, they will have a lot of, like, the way you usually treat them, right, you can try to give them like a basal level of insulin, right? Those basal insulins, they last very long. They have like almost like literally no peak, right? They are just basally there, right? These are things like glargine, things like Detemir. Detemir spelled Detemir. And then another one you see on an exam that you don't find in many resources is degludec, degludec, right? So glargine, Detemir, degludec, right? Glargine, Detemir, degludec, right? And then usually for those people, you go ahead and then give them like insulin that they take with meals, right? Because again, you're giving them that basal insulin. That's good. But again, when they eat, they need an insulin spike. Because remember, these basal insulins don't spike. They don't have peaks, right? So you need to give them an insulin that peaks, right? So usually you give them like an ultra rapid acting insulin. These are things like Lespro, aspart, glulisin. Glulisin is spelled GLULISINE. Aspart is ASPART. Lispro is LISPRO, right? So you give those things, right? So Lispro, aspart, glulisin, they're super rapid acting insulins. That's what most people take when they're, you know, about to eat, right? Because those things, you know, they peak very quickly within, I think, about 15 minutes of taking them, right? And their duration of action is like, you know, like maybe like, I don't know, like 2 to 4 hours roughly, something like that. You don't need to memorize those specific numbers for your USMLE exams. But then there are other kinds of insulin though, right? You know, besides the ultra rapid acting insulin, there's the regular insulin. Regular insulin sometimes is called rapid acting insulin, right? Regular insulin is actually kind of high yield on NBM exams for certain reasons, right? So one is cheaper than the ultra rapid acting insulins. But that's actually the only insulin that you can give IV, right? That's literally the only insulin you can give IV. And that's actually the one we use in DKA and HHNS management, right? So when a person gets insulin regular, you are literally managing their DKA and their HHNS. And then if a person has you know, there's another kind of insulin called NPH. NPH is what sometimes you can, you know, its duration of action is about 12 hours. It's cheaper than the basal insulins, that glargine, degludec, Detemir business. So sometimes some people take like MPH twice a day to cover them for 24 hours as their basal insulin, right? But again, the ideal thing for a diabetic is to get the glargine, Detemir, or degludec plus the ultra rapid actants, right? To more closely replicate normal physiology, essentially, right? So, and again, because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, right? Again, those people can have other autoimmune diseases in the NBME question you get, right? So they can have like Hashimoto's, they can have like Addison's, they can have like vitiligo, they can have pernicious anemia, right? This is almost like a construct that the NBME uses. Whenever they give you a question about a person that has an autoimmune disease, go ahead and check the question. Most of the time, maybe like 80% or something like that, those people also have some other autoimmune disease kind of going on in their lives, right? So that's all I think I'm going to say with type 1 diabetes, right? So let's go ahead and talk about type 2 diabetes, right? Let's talk about type 2 diabetes, right? So again, I've kind of introduced it a little bit already, right? I said that, you know, this one has a much stronger genetic predisposition compared with type 1 diabetes, right? Again, I talked about those twin concordance studies, right? And the big thing with type 2 diabetes is you just have bad insulin resistance, right? So like your insulin is around, but it's not working, right? Your body is very resistant to that insulin. And again, many people just memorize, oh, insulin resistance, insulin resistance, insulin resistance. Yes, that's great. But that's not the only, like, you got to understand the little pathophys here, right? So remember that insulin works through tyrosine kinase receptors, right? Insulin works through tyrosine kinase receptors. So the thing is, insulin, since it works through tyrosine kinase receptors, if you have like mutations in those receptors, right, then you're not going to be getting that insulin effect, right? So even if insulin is around, if you have a receptor defect, right, then you're not going to be getting those effects from insulin, right? And, you know, if you don't get those effects from insulin, right? Again, we said that insulin, one of the things it does is it causes your muscle cells, because your muscle is an insulin-independent tissue, right? It causes your muscle cells to take up glucose, right? So they can store it as glycogen, right? So again, your muscles, if there's no insulin around, your muscles are kind of starving for energy because they're not able to get in glucose. So your muscles start depending on alternate forms of energy, right? To get, you know, basically to work, right? So one thing that muscles can use, because they have it at baseline, they have a lot of protein, right? So they can break down their protein, right? They can break down their protein. Again, another thing insulin does is it causes your adipose cells to take up glucose so that you can ultimately make it into fatty acids. But again, we said that insulin activates lipoprotein lipase, right? So because it activates lipoprotein lipase, it essentially helps you break down triglycerides that we find floating in the bloodstream into monoacylglycerol and 2-free fatty acids, you know, kind of gets into the adipose cell, and then you make fatty acids, right? But again, insulin also upregulates the production of fatty acids, right? I mean, we know that there's this enzyme, right, called acetyl-CoA carboxylase. Remember, that's the rate-limiting enzyme of fatty acid synthesis. Insulin actually activates that enzyme, right? So insulin does all this stuff. And insulin also even makes your cells take up amino acids so they can make like polypeptides, right? So the thing is, when a person's insulin doesn't work, then they're going to basically have the reverse of all those things happening, right? In fact, all these counter-regulatory hormones will start holding sway. So what are those counter-regulatory hormones? These are things like glucagon. These are things like epinephrine, right? So glucagon, epinephrine, they'll start holding sway. And we know that those things, right, they promote like breakdown of fatty triglycerides into free fatty acids, right? And as you break down triglycerides into free fatty acids, those free fatty acids can undergo beta oxidation, right? And if you have a lot of beta oxidation, you would already begin to see that, wow, you can make a ton of acetyl-CoA. Well, acetyl-CoA is used to make ketone bodies, right? So you can see why people, especially people that have type 1 diabetes, those ketone bodies, right? So things like acetoacetate, and you do need to know the specific identities of ketone bodies, not just for step 1, but step 2, CK, step 3. So things like acetoacetate, things like beta-hydroxybutyrate, right? Sometimes even acetone, right? So you make all those ketone bodies, right? And that's the thing that can essentially throw you into DKA, right? As a diabetic, right? Throw you into DKA as a diabetic, right? And again, that acetone, which again is a ketone body, that acetone is the thing that in some cases, you see some people that are in DKA and they have like this fruity odor to their breath, right? That fruity odor to their breath is essentially acetone, right? And you can already begin to see, right? Because you're forming these keto acids, right? You're essentially increasing the number of unaccounted for anions in your body, right? So those people develop a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. So the body will be like, okay, let's try to compensate. Let's try to compensate, right? So the way your body will try to compensate is to be like, okay, you know what, guys, let's blow off a ton of CO2. Let's induce a respiratory acidosis, right? So the thing is, those people try to start taking all these deep breaths, right? That's what's called a Kussmaul breathing, actually, right? Remember, Kussmaul's breathing is not the same thing as Kussmaul's sign. You don't want to mix those things up on an NBME. Kussmaul's sign is something we find in people that have constrictive pericarditis on NBME exams. But again, that's not the goal of today's discussion, so we're going to keep going, right? So that's why these people get all these problems, right? And in fact, if you know about these counter-regulatory hormones, right? I said glucagon, I said epinephrine. Cortisol is also a counter-regulatory hormone, right? In fact, there are many other things that can cause diabetes besides just like, you know, these things I'm talking about with type 1 versus type 2 or whatever, right? Like if a person has Cushing's syndrome for any cause, you know, because they're taking chronic glucocorticoids, or they have small cell lung cancer that's producing ectopic ACTH, or they have like a cortisol secreting adenoma or whatever, right? Those people literally can develop diabetes, right? And also people that are stressed, right? Because think about it, when you're stressed, what hormone are you releasing? You're going to release a ton of cortisol, right? You're going to release a ton of cortisol. And again, cortisol is a diabetogenic hormone, right? That's why people that are under chronic levels of stress, they tend to have, you know, bigger BMIs, obesity, higher incidence of diabetes. Again, it's not a mistake that when people get into med school, the vast majority of them, is only if they have, like, you know, very strong personal discipline, they gain weight, right? Again, you're not gaining weight because of, like, for fun. No, you're gaining it because you're under, like, just very high amounts of stress. Again, the U.S. medical system, just the way it's set up, it's not the most ideal from a lifestyle perspective. Again, I feel like there are many changes that could be made to just the whole U.S. medical system. I read something on Reddit recently of a person taking their life because they didn't match. Again, many people have taken their lives because they didn't match. We really shouldn't be having those kinds of things happening. The U.S. healthcare system, especially the medical education system, really needs a lot of change. Really, really needs a lot of change. But that's a totally different conversation here. So cortisol is diabetogenic, right? Growth hormone, right? I mean, think about it. Growth hormone, remember when you release growth hormone, it causes you to make this thing called IGF-1. What do you think IGF-1 stands for? Insulin-like growth factor, right? Insulin-like growth factor, right? So the thing is, growth hormone, right, is actually involved in raising a person's blood glucose levels, right? So again, it's diabetogenic in a sense, right? And also, many other things can cause diabetes. Like, they can give you a question about a person that, you know, has high glucose levels, but then they tell you that, on abdominal x-ray, you can see calcifications around the pancreas. Well, that person has chronic pancreatitis, right? If a person has chronic pancreatitis, their pancreas is essentially burned out. Well, there's no source of insulin. They're essentially going to have diabetes, right? If a person has a glucagonoma, right? Think about it. When you have a glucagonoma, we literally just said that glucagon is a counter-regulatory hormone, right? Your glucagon is going to go up, right? And that's, again, going to cause you, because again, glucagon, right, causes you to upregulate the breakdown of glycogen, right? Glycogenolysis, and it also increases gluconeogenesis, right? So again, all these things are geared towards increasing your blood glucose levels, right? So usually in a person that has a glucagonoma, you know, they'll have diabetes, and then they'll have the skin rash, right, that we call necrolytic migratory erythema, right? If a person has mumps, again, mumps, the virus, again, think about it. Mumps is a viral infection. How does your, what arm of your immune system responds to viral infections? It's T cells, right? So when a person has mumps, remember, mumps loves to infect the pancreas. When you infect the pancreas, you can get a very powerful inflammatory response from T cells, and that can wreak havoc and destroy the pancreas. That can ultimately lead the person to developing a diabetes, right? So there are many things that can cause diabetes, right? If a person has hyperthyroidism, right, again, thyroid hormone increases the person's blood glucose levels, right? Again, that can ultimately cause diabetes for a patient, right? Or if a person has cystic fibrosis, think about it, right? If a person has cystic fibrosis, they're not going to be able to secrete pancreatic stuff, right? And, you know, secrete enzymes out of the pancreas. Those enzymes, they are very toxic. They will auto digest the pancreas. If a person's pancreas is gone, well, guess what? They're not going to be able to make insulin, right? So they're going to develop diabetes as a result of that, right? So these are just all things that can cause diabetes on an MBM exam. I mean, to be honest with you, in my heart and in my soul, I'm almost certain that this podcast is going to need two parts. There's just so many things you can integrate with diabetes. And these integrations, I'm not saying them because I just want to make integrations. I'm saying them because they show up on exams, right? And again, the thing is, when you have these integrations, when you have all these different contexts for the material, it's just much easier to remember. And the thing is, doesn't matter how hard the question they write for you gets, you'll be able to figure out exactly what they're going after, right? Because the understanding is there, right? So again, I always tell my students this: when you're learning, try to make sure that you're making integrations, you're learning these contexts and things like that. That's why I love to make my podcasts in this fashion. Again, it may seem a little unscripted, which is true for the most part, right? But it's a great way to learn, right? That's why, again, thankfully, I still remember many of these things, right? That's why I still remember many of these things. So I said that, you know, I've kind of talked about the pathophysiology behind DKA, and again, how all these counter-regulatory hormones are holding sway, and then the person gets in trouble, right? So the thing with these counter-regulatory hormones, you may be like, okay, Divine, why are these counter-regulatory hormones holding sway? Well, again, remember the thing I said at the very beginning about how these pancreatic beta cells, they secrete insulin, and that insulin on its way out of the islets shuts down glucagon production? Well, if a person has like type 1 diabetes, for example, they literally are not making any glucagon. Glucagon is going to be secreted in very high amounts, right? Because again, there's no insulin to inhibit it, right? So that can cause problems. But also if you're stressed, right? So usually many times the thing that flips people into DK is either they don't take their insulin. I mean, again, obviously, if you don't take your insulin, your glucagon is going to be really high. But if you're stressed for whatever reason, so let's say the person has really severe illness, or the person exercises, or the person, let me not say exercise, but if a person has really severe illness, right, or they have big stress of some sort, that's going to make them make a ton of cortisol, right? That's going to, again, cortisol is a diabetogenic hormone, right? So those people are going to have high levels of glucose, right? And that's going to cause problems, right? And again, we remember that glucagon especially, causes you to break down glycogen to form glucose, right? And again, it also encourages fatty acid breakdown, beta oxidation, right? And all that stuff, right? In fact, if you think about it, the rate limiting enzyme of beta oxidation, right? Carnitine acyl transferase. Sometimes you may see some NBM exams call it carnitine palmitoyl transferase. I remember it's inhibited by malonyl-CoA, right? But again, how do you make malonyl-CoA? You make malonyl-CoA because insulin is promoting fatty acid synthesis, right? So again, if you have no insulin, you're not making malonyl-CoA. There is no inhibition of carnitine acyltransferase, right? So again, you're going to be promoting beta oxidation, right? So again, you're going to be forming all these ketone bodies. So you see, glucagon plays a big role in this, right? So that kind of explains why people that have type 2 diabetes, where they still have adequate, you know, they still have insulin around, they may not necessarily go all the way to ketone body synthesis. Because again, remember, ketone bodies come because you've done a lot of beta oxidation of fatty acids. You've made a ton of acetyl-CoA. And then that acetyl-CoA is used to make ketone bodies. So people that have type 2 diabetes, at least when their pancreas has not completely burned out, that insulin they have is typically sufficient to inhibit the production of glucagon, right? Or at least bring down its activity. So they don't make all that acetyl-CoA, so they don't really make ketone bodies, right? That's the thing that creates this thing called a hyperglycemic, hypoketotic, whatever, blah, 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 blah state. It's called HHNS, HHNK or whatever. You can look up what it means. That's not the main subject of this discussion, right? So that's why those people do not go into ketosis, right? That's why those people do not go into ketosis, right? So we see that again, when your body notices that, wow, I'm not getting any insulin effect. What is going on here? What's going on here? So your body is like, okay, let me keep secreting as much insulin as possible. Well, the thing is, if you keep secreting as much insulin as possible, again, we said that as you're making more and more insulin, you're making more and more C-peptide. But another thing that you're making more and more of as you secrete a ton of this insulin is something called amylin, right? The thing is that amylin, you can already begin to see that it kind of sounds a lot like amyloid, right? So that amylin, as you secrete more of it, that amylin can begin to form these like beta-pleated sheet structures, essentially begin to polymerize, and it can form amyloid. And that amyloid can deposit in the pancreas, right? And when that amyloid deposits in the pancreas, right, again, you can have this apocrine birefringence with Congo red staining. Over time, the person's, because again, amyloid, right, is not good. It makes whatever it deposits in like dysfunctional. And as you make those things dysfunctional, they stop working, right? So the thing is, over time, those people's pancreas can burn out. And if you burn out the pancreas, at some point, you're going to stop making insulin, right? So that's why many times if a person lives for long enough with type 2 diabetes, especially if they're not controlling things well, they're going to ultimately form amyloid in the pancreas, burn out the pancreas, stop secreting insulin, right? And then over time, you'll then start having to give those people insulin, right? In fact, because again, many of the problems with type 2 diabetes are, again, you're not getting that insulin effect because you have like a receptor mutation or whatever. the thing that usually happens, right, in type 2 diabetes, we usually tend to give these people at least to start metformin, right? Metformin is a drug that actually raises a person's insulin sensitivity, right? Metformin is a drug that raises a person's insulin sensitivity. And by the way, metformin is one of those drugs that also causes weight loss. Remember the other one I said that causes weight loss, where your, where your GLP-1 agonists, right? Like exenatide, liraglutide, right? Metformin also causes weight loss, right? Metformin actually increases insulin sensitivity. So you may be like, Divine, how does metformin increase insulin sensitivity? Well, the thing with metformin is that metformin actually has the ability to activate something called AMP kinase, right? So metformin actually increases the activity of something called AMP kinase. So you may say, oh, Divine, AMP kinase, how is that helpful? How is that helpful? Well, the thing is, AMP kinase actually, you know, throw some signaling, because again, remember, kinases, their job is to phosphorylate enzymes, right? When you phosphorylate another enzyme, in some cases, it can lead to its activation, right? So the thing is, AMP kinase phosphorylates certain enzymes, and those enzymes, their job is to inhibit the activity of phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase and glucose-6-phosphatase, right? And we know that these are like literally legit enzymes that are necessary. Remember, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase literally converts, oxaloacetate to phosphoenolpyruvate, right? Remember, that step uses GTP, right? So if you inhibit that, you're inhibiting one of the key steps of gluconeogenesis. Remember, gluconeogenesis, you know, kind of starts with pyruvate, right? Pyruvate carboxylase will convert it to oxaloacetate, and acetyl-CoA actually activates that process. And then that oxaloacetate is then converted to phosphoenolpyruvate by PepsiCo, right? Again, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. And then you make a phosphoenolpyruvate, and then, you know, it keeps backtracking until you get to glucose-6-phosphate. And then glucose-6-phosphatase, which is in the endoplasmic reticulum, will convert the glucose-6-phosphate to glucose. So the thing that happens is that when AMP kinase, right, so metformin is an AMP kinase activator. When you activate AMP kinase will phosphorylate certain enzymes that will lead to an inhibition of phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase and glucose-6-phosphatase, which are key enzymes in gluconeogenesis, right? So if you inhibit those enzymes, then gluconeogenesis, which predominantly occurs in the liver, right, doesn't work anymore, right? And if it doesn't work anymore, right, you can see that, oh, you're essentially cutting off one pathway that could potentially raise your blood glucose levels, right? So that's essentially the mechanism behind metformin being good at increasing insulin sensitivity, right? And again, because we also do gluconeogenesis in the kidneys, we can see that metformin can potentially be nephrotoxic. In fact, when a person's kidneys don't work, you don't want to give those people metformin, right? Or if you're even putting a person, like they love to give these NBME questions where a person is a diabetic, is admitted to the hospital, and let's say maybe they have a PE or whatever, right? And you're about to start them on some, you want to maybe do a CT angiogram or whatever, right? Before you give a person iodinated contrast, you need to go ahead and stop their metformin, right? Because again, iodinated contrast can cause issues with the kidneys, right? So that can, again, raise the person's risk of metformin toxicity. And again, metformin, I said, causes weight loss. But what is one of those big things with metformin, right, in terms of toxicity? Metformin, in terms of toxicity, one big thing to keep at the back of your mind with it is the fact that it causes lactic acidosis, right? So you may say, oh, Divine, why can people get a lactic acidosis with metformin? Again, it all goes back. It's not something you just need to memorize, right? It's not something you need to memorize. It's something that you should, you should understand, right? The thing is, if you inhibit hepatic gluconeogenesis by mechanisms which we've essentially described already, you can already begin to see that the Cori cycle is not going to work, right? So what in the world is the Cori cycle? The Cori cycle is, if you're exercising or whatever, or your muscle cells, they make a ton of lactic acid as a byproduct of glycolysis, they ship that lactic acid to the liver, and then lactate dehydrogenase will convert that lactic acid to pyruvate, right? Remember, lactate dehydrogenase can work both ways. It's a bidirectional enzyme. And then that pyruvate, you know, through gluconeogenesis, you know, again, pyruvate carboxylase and then PBCK, and then all the way to glucose 6-phosphatase, you make glucose. And then that glucose is shipped back to the muscles, right, for it to use. And also, that's a pathway that operates with red blood cells. Well, if by inhibiting hepatic gluconeogenesis, again, we talked about the mechanism of how metformin ultimately leads to an inhibition of PBCK and glucose 6-phosphatase, then you've essentially short-circuited that Cori cycle, right? So if you short-circuit that Cori cycle, it will make sense that your lactic acid should build up, because you don't have many pathways that can help you deal with that anymore, right? So lactic acidosis, a life-threatening lactic acidosis, is a big, big, big toxicity with metformin. And metformin, obviously, as well, can cause a B12 deficiency, right? It actually, there are many different ways it messes up, causes B12 deficiency. Like, it can mess up intrinsic factor, it can mess up B12 reabsorption in the terminal ileum, right? It just does many different things, right? But metformin can definitely cause a B12 deficiency. And another series of drugs, diabetes drugs, right? Those are PPAR gamma activators, right? Those are your TZDs, right? Your thiazolidinediones, right? Again, they are activators of PPAR gamma, right? PPAR gamma, and these drugs, by the way, cause weight gain, right? So PPAR gamma, the thing with PPAR gamma is that it's like a transcription factor, right? And it actually increases like many, you know, it basically like causes you to causes your adipocytes to work better, right? So they work better because by activating PPAR gamma, it's like a transcription factor that makes, how do I put this? It basically like increases the activity of certain enzymes that are necessary for fatty acid synthesis, right? So it's almost like, oh, you know, I have insulin resistance, but by using a different receptor, this PPAR gamma receptor, I mean, by activating PPAR gamma, I'm essentially creating an alternate pathway for me to better utilize free fatty acids, right? So that I can store them. But again, if you notice, if you're making more and more fatty acids, making more and more triglycerides, that's going to make you fat, right? These drugs, again, they cause weight gain, although they also cause fluid retention because they are PPAR gamma receptors in the nephron, which, you know, cause you to reabsorb more fluid. And as you hold on to that water, right, that's not great for a person that has heart failure because their hearts cannot handle that increased fluid, right? So these PPAR gamma activators, right, these are drugs like rosiglitazone, pioglitazone, troglitazone. Again, they are contraindicated in people that have CHF, right? And also, you can see their name, thiazolidinediones. So they control like thiol groups. So if a person has like a sulfur allergy, maybe not the best idea to give these people thiazolidinediones. And also, sulfur allergies are, you know, not the greatest for people that are taking sulfonylureas, right? So you don't want to give sulfonylureas, especially the first generation ones. Those are not good. Those are bad. People that have sulfur allergies, right? So just, again, things to kind of keep at the back of your mind on exams. I guess since I've kind of talked about most of the diabetes drugs, maybe let me just maybe mention the rest, so that I know that I'm done with this section of conversation. But again, there is many, many, many more things that I really want to say with diabetes. Again, this may be a 2 or 3 part podcast. But again, I know you may be like, wow, Divine, diabetes is a small topic. But again, you see I'm integrating on many other things that are USMLE relevant, right? So let's talk about the remaining diabetes drugs, right? So remember, they are the alpha-glucosidase inhibitors. Because remember, your intestinal enterocytes, they cannot reabsorb they cannot reabsorb disaccharides. They can only reabsorb monosaccharides, right? So the thing is, there's a disaccharide, you have disaccharidases on your brush border that breaks down these disaccharides to monosaccharides, right? So you can give a disaccharidase inhibitor, right? Alpha-glucosidase is literally a disaccharidase. So if you give an alpha-glucosidase inhibitor, right, that will essentially inhibit that disaccharidase on your brush border. So many times on exams, they can ask you, oh, what's the site of action of these alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, like, you know, Icarbose and Miglitol? Again, they work on the brush border, so you won't be able to break down your disaccharides. So they will stay in the GI tract. They will attract fluid, right? So that can cause diarrhea. But in addition to causing diarrhea, remember, as glucose stays in your, as those disaccharides stay in your GI tract, you're essentially creating Thanksgiving in your GI tract for those bacteria. So as the bacteria consumes those disaccharides, they form all these gases, right, through fermentation. So you get a lot of bloating, a lot of flatulence, right? But then another glucose set of drugs, right, are those SGLT2 inhibitors, right? So they all end in flozin, right? Canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin. Those drugs, right, they inhibit the SGLT2 receptors that we find in the proximal convoluted tubule, right? So by inhibiting those receptors, glucose is going to stay on the urine side of your nephrons, and that's going to attract water, and you're going to pee all those things out. In fact, these drugs actually help with weight loss, right? But again, you can already begin to see that if a person's kidneys don't work, because these drugs, they literally have to be filtered at the glomerulus, right? And then they then attack your proximal tubules. That's how they work, right? So if a person's kidneys don't work at baseline, well, your GFR is not great, right? So you're not going to be able to filter those drugs into the nephron, right? So you're going to get less effectiveness, right? But also, again, these drugs, because they put so much glucose in your urine, you can already begin to see that, again, you can have like an increased risk of urinary tract infections. You can even have like necrotizing fasciitis of the perineum, right? That's what's called Fournier's, F-O-U-R-N-I-E-R, with an apostrophe and an S, right? Fournier's gangrene, right? So those drugs are kind of dangerous from that perspective, although they also reduce a person's myocardial infarction risk. Because myocardial infarction, if you can do anything to decrease the risk in diabetics, that's a great thing, right? MI is actually the most common cause of death in diabetics, right? That's like a very nice high yield step 2 CK, step 3 factor. The most common cause of death in diabetics is an acute MI, right? So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step 1, step 2 CK, step 3, preclinical medical exams, third-year shelf exams. And if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for your internal medicine training exam or your internal medicine boards, I do also offer tutoring for that. And again, I've talked about the step 2 CK courses I hold. And step one, a lot of what I do now is one-on-one tutoring, just again, scheduling and things. But I really plan to, hopefully in the future, hold a step 1 course around June, right? So if you're interested in that, just shoot me an email and I can give you some more details on that. And then I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So please subscribe to that. That's where I post the videos that I make. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, at least the most recent 150. It's completely out of my hands. It's like a WordPress rule. It's not much I can do about that. So if you want all the episodes that I've made from episode 1, go ahead and go to my website. All the episodes are there. Right. And you can even download the episodes there. And by the way, the website is divineinterventionpodcast.com. If you go there, if you subscribe to the WordPress website, then whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. Right. You get an email notification. So I'll just encourage you to subscribe again so that you can get that notification whenever I make a podcast. So I want to go ahead and discuss a quick life lesson this morning. And it's this statement that many can commit, but few are faithful, right? I'll say that again. Many can commit, but few are faithful, right? Many can commit, but few are faithful, right? So the thing is, many people make commitments. And again, many times when I bring these life lessons, right, obviously they're probably relevant to most people in this world, but they're especially relevant to med students, right? So the thing is, there's a big difference between making a commitment and then being faithful to that commitment, right? The thing is, if you make a commitment, you're like, okay, yes, I will do this. Yes, I will do that. Yes, I will do this. Yes, I will do that, right? But after you make that commitment, you really follow through, right? Many can commit, but few are faithful. Commitment is cheap. You can get a commitment from someone, right? But how many people actually follow through on their commitments, right? You see some people, they come into med school, they have a solid plan, solid plan for how to crush and kill step 1, right? But then they don't follow through. Right, they make that commitment, but then they are not disciplined. Right, really, to be a faithful person is you're basically a person that sticks with your commitments. Right, those people, they just don't stick it through. Right, they never stick it through. Right, and then they notice the end of their second year comes, they botch step 1, and then after they botch step 1, they have this magic thought that they will crush step 2. Again, it's possible. I mean, there are many people I've worked with that didn't do well on step 1, but again, I had to work with them extensively, and then they crush step 2. Right. But the thing is, many times, one of the most important predictors of step 2 CK performance, guess what, is step 1 performance. That's why I even tell people, when they make step 1 pass fail, you should still study hard for it. If not, you'll find out that you botch step 2. Right. You got to follow through on your commitments. You can't just make commitments and just not keep them. Right. Even in the Bible, it says that if you make a vow, you know, you should follow through on your vow, right? God does not have any pleasure in fools, right? Literally, that's what God calls people that don't keep their vows, right? So be faithful, right? When you make commitments, when you have a good, solid plan, don't keep changing that plan because you saw someone else doing something new. No. Just stay faithful, right? I mean, like, one of the reasons that a marriage lasts is because, you know, because again, many people, they make these marriage commitments. Oh, I do. I will live with you for the rest of my life in sickness and in health, blah, 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 right? They make all those commitments, right? But again, faithfulness is the thing that will then keep that marriage going, right? Again, you see many people, they invest so much in the wedding day. Again, there's nothing wrong with investing in wedding day, right? Wedding day is the day of commitment, right? But then your actual marriage is is the faithfulness part of things, right? Again, faithfulness is the thing that keeps a marriage going, right? Faithfulness, right? So, and again, you know, being faithful is not the easiest thing in the world because there'll be many challenges that arise, right? Like, when you make a commitment, that commitment is going to be tested. If you make a commitment and there's literally like no testing, you didn't make the right kind of commitment, right? Most times when you make a commitment, a challenge will show up, right? But again, you need to stay faithful through all those vicissitudes, all those problems, right? Like in any marriage, right? There's going to be there's literally no perfect marriage. There's going to be problems in any marriage, right? Even on day one of marriage, you may quarrel with your life partner, with your spouse or whatever, right? But again, you've made a commitment. Now be faithful to that commitment, right? Again, that's the thing. That's why the fact that a wedding is, oh, wow, they spent tons and tons of money on the wedding. It's in the nicest part of town. It's in a great hall. 2 million people came for the wedding. Doesn't matter. It doesn't do diddly squat for that wedding, right? If the people that make that commitment are not faithful, right? If the people that make that commitment are not faithful, that's why even the Bible says that, you know, he that endures to the end is the one that will be saved, right? The person that is literally like, because again, it's very easy to commit your life to Jesus. Jesus, I accept you as my Lord and Savior, blah, 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 blah. And again, obviously, you need to take that first step, right? But again, you need to endure to the end to get that salve, to be, you know, to make it to heaven, right? So that's the thing, right? Like you need to stay faithful. Again, commitment is cheap, but faithfulness is expensive, right? And again, there are not many people that are faithful. In fact, if you're trying to hire someone, right, always try to look for that characteristic of faithfulness. Because those people, right, they will follow through on their commitments, right? They'll follow through on their commitments. Again, faithfulness is not something that is exactly prized in this world we live in today, which is really sad because it's a very key component of being successful in life. But, you know, again, that's a different conversation. But again, I'm just saying, as a med student, as a healthcare professional, right, if you've made a commitment, stay faithful to it. That faithfulness is the thing that will give you results from those commitments that you have made. So thank you for listening to this. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. There will definitely be a part 2. That's probably going to be the next podcast. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.